The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I was pretty sure nobody was going to be here. I thought I was going to be one of those, not, I'd just be standing here talking to the, you know, four people from Philadelphia who hate baseball. I'm going to try to be quick so you can make the last of it. So I'm going to read one poem and a paragraph from a story, answer three stories, then we'll be done. You didn't disagree. And DVR. But somebody's going to don't shout out scores. Don't say nothing. Nobody. There are people here recording it. Don't say anything. When I walk by security guards, we're getting ready. You know, it's great. So, but you know, my son's all crazy. He's a baseball fan, so he's happy. I promised him that next year, no matter where the World Series is, whoever's playing, I'm going to take him to the first game. So, yeah, because my basketball team's gone. So now some white guys from Oklahoma took an Indian guy's shit. There's an unusual story. So it's good to be here. I don't know if you heard, but early this summer I got in trouble for hammering on the Kindle. I had said at the Booksellers Expo that I saw a woman on an airplane with a Kindle and I wanted to hit her, which got written in the New York Times without, you know, her mentioning that it was a punchline, and so not literally, but comedy is violent. So I ended up getting all these to my website, about 1,000 in about 2 days, about 1,000 really angry emails. Some of them were just irrational and crazy. It proved pretty much though that really dedicated Kindle lovers don't understand what a metaphor is. it's true. But they also would prove things about their reading abilities, cultural literacy, by saying things like, I don't even know who you are. You write back, well, I'm kind of big. Now, there were compelling arguments, people with physical disabilities pointing out that the Kindle really digital books really helped them because of physical difficulties in reading, eyesight or their hands. And so, you know, to them, I said, yes, whenever I talk about this, I'll certainly mention that digital technology books are great for people with certain physical disabilities. And I perfectly understand that. But there are also those people who would say things like, it's great for traveling. It's great for traveling. I don't have to haul 15 books around. But that doesn't work with me. I like hauling books around. I'm very Catholic that way. I'm on book tour now. I get one or two books at every bookstore I'm in. So I just brought an extra roller bag because I knew this was going to happen. So if you see some guy in the morning going to the train tomorrow with two roller bags like this, and then I get on the airplane and I'm paying $75 extra for my bag, and they're saying, well, can't you do something with that? And I'm saying, no. I need to carry these around. It's the 13 stations of the paperback. But after it happened, actually Amazon called me and wanted to have a meeting. Now, you may or may not know that Amazon is in Seattle, its headquarters, and the building is a former hospital. It sits above Seattle, this giant, giant, imposing building over Seattle. It's like Mordor. You know, there's a giant flaming vagina over it. It is, you know. That's what the movie, it's it. What is that, Frodo? I think it's a giant flaming vagina. So they called me, and So we're going to have a meeting to talk about the Kindle. And by the way, you see Barnes & Noble's new one is called The Nook. Isn't that a silly-ass name, The Nook? Did anybody in the meeting say, you know, people are going to call it The Nookie? Well, that's good. It sexes the whole thing up. So I thought I was going to be going up to Amazon to have a meeting with a bunch of people, and I didn't. They said, well, let's meet downtown for lunch. And I thought, ooh, Wild Ginger, back room, important place. One guy came. Not such a powerful Indian after all. But they did give me a free Kindle. So at the meeting, the guy handed it to me, and he said, we've downloaded some things on there we think you and your family will like. I thought, that's pretty presumptuous. And then I remembered we shop on Amazon, so... So I was looking at the list on the Kindle and going, oh, wow, I wanted that one. I took it home to experiment with it. I read about the first 20, 30 pages of The Great Gatsby and got... It wasn't interesting to me. My wife took it, and she liked the recipes. The joy of cooking was on there, so she had it set on the counter. But she was worried about splattering it, so she wrapped it in cellophane. Just rezzed it up, man, you know. I can't wait for these things finally get to a reasonable price point somewhere in the future. I can't wait for Indians to start showing up with them all rezzed out, you know, all duct taped and buttons falling off and bumper stickers on the back, you know. Custer had it coming, you know. But she didn't like it when you change screens. It flashes a little black thing. You know, there's a black screen, and she didn't like the flash. It bothered her eyes. So my youngest son had no interest whatsoever, my 8-year-old. And my 12-year-old, he wasn't interested until we were in the airport. Now, I told him, you know, I can download it, because we took it traveling to test that whole theory out about traveling with it. I told him, you know, we're waiting in the waiting area, and I said, I can download a book right here, right now. It'll be here in seconds. He goes, really? I go, yeah, any book on here. There's like 250,000 choices, anything you want. How about The Lightning Thief? It'll be here as quick as lightning. Did the thing, bang, it's right here. Wow. So he read it for a while in the waiting room, and then he read it for about 20 minutes on the airplane, and then he got bored, gave it to me, and played Star Wars Mad Libs with his little brother. So my family was done with it in about a week. So I called all my friends, and I said, well, I got a Kindle here. I want to do a highly unscientific experiment. I want all of you to borrow it for a couple days, and you're all lefty commie bastards who are underpaid and underemployed, so I will download any book you want because, you know, W so fucked up the economy that the only one making any money right now is a Native American poet. It's true. I mean, it's crazy. It's true, you know. And so so my friend Justin borrowed it. Well, my friend Deirdre borrowed it first, and she loved it. You idiot, she said. And I could very well be an idiot about all this. She said, you idiot, I love it. When you're done with it, give it to me. But I'm not going to give it to her because she's my best friend, and she's a lesbian, and I've been secretly in love with her for 19 years, so... This is my only way of withholding anything from her. Then my friend Justin borrowed it, and he read it for a while, and he just said, it was kind of sterile. I mean, it's cool, but it's kind of sterile. It's like masturbating with a condom on. My first thought was, you mean there's some other way? My mom was OCD, so we were poor too. There was a limited sock budget. You know, I didn't catch it this time, but there's always the mother in the audience who has a dawning of realization when I make the sock joke. They're going, I thought their feet were bad. She's flashing back to her brothers. My young adult novel, True Diary, has been challenged and attempted to ban it in various schools throughout the country, and it always relates back to masturbation, which is hilarious. People still freak out about it. There are people in the audience right now who are really uncomfortable with me talking about masturbation. Well, I didn't know. Apparently, only 16-year-old Democratic teenage boys masturbate. I thought it was a bipartisan activity. Thought those two things we could agree on, gravity and masturbation. But for those of you who have the book challenged or banned or people are freaking out about it, here's something you can tell anybody who gets uncomfortable. I was invited to the George H.W. Presidential Library to read from True Diary. And I read the masturbation chapter. To 1,000 Texas high school students, and they loved it. So you parents who are having issues, your kids don't. So I think you might want to talk, because they're whacking away. And if you're not talking about or accepting with or dealing with it, then you're creating this gulf between you when it comes to very important matters, sexuality and maturity and adulthood and responsibility and honesty and openness and emotional maturity, and you're leaving a huge gap in your relationship with your kid, especially if it's a boy, because just, you can go read a study. There's a study, they've done a study, it's amazing the studies they do. They have footage of not girls as much, but boys in the womb going for it. It's true. Ask a doctor, man. You can go online. It's like, oh, man, yeah. All of this is in the sequel to True Diary that I'm writing, too. This is the third chapter. So, anyway... We still have the Kindle. We haven't opened it. There's dust collecting on it. And my French publisher was in town, and he didn't want to play with it, but his friend did, his childhood friend, and the friend was playing with it, and he said, but it's pretty. The aesthetics are pretty, but when you walk into a bookstore, you smell the books. You feel the books. You hear the books. You taste the books. The Kindle, books is... There's a preparation, there's a sensuality to book reading and the Kindle. There's no prep. What is the word for foreplay? There's no foreplay. So, but life is changing. I feel like I've been on a funeral march. So I'm going to read a couple poems here and then a little piece of fiction about the past. The first one is called Ode for Mixtapes. You know, you colonized my ass, you Euros, you know. And the beautiful thing you colonized me with is music. You know, that was when I first started, you know, falling in love with white folks, was when the first time I heard Waylon Jennings or Hank Williams or Patsy Cline or Bruce Springsteen, you know, Bay City Rollers. But now you're rushing off with your technology, just whoosh. And I love my iPod, too. You know, I love my cell phone, too. But I'm declaring that vinyl and cassette are indigenous. And I'm going to protect them, even if you don't. So this is called Ode to Mixtapes. These days, it's too easy to make mixtapes. CD burners, iPods, and iTunes have taken the place of vinyl and cassette. And soon enough, clever introverts will create quicker point-and-click ways to declare one's love, lust, friendship, and favor. But I miss the labor of making old-school mixtapes, the mid-air acrobatics of recording one song at a time. It sometimes took days. to play, choose, pause, ponder, record, replay, erase, and replace. But there was no magic wand. It was blue-collar work. A great mixtape was sculpture designed to seduce and let the hounds loose. A great mixtape was a three-chord parade led by that first song, something bold and brave. A heat seeker like Prince with Cream. Or Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye. The next song was always Patsy Cline's Sweet Dreams or something by Hank. But oh, the last track was the vessel that contained the most devotion and pain and made promises that you couldn't take back. Oh, no, you don't know. I read that poem at Phoenix, and then I asked a man in the front row if he remembered the first mixtape he made for his wife, and he was in his 60s, and he goes, yes. Do you remember the first song? Yes. Can you sing it? And then he turned to her and, I've seen fire, I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never. And he sang about as well as me, but I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. And she burst into tears. So, has anybody burst into tears over an iPod? We know how you make those CDs. You burn them. 5 minutes. Cassette tape? That's hard work. So, young folks, you want to impress the subject of your affections? Make a cassette tape. And you older folks, give it a try. You know, get romance back into your relationship. Make a cassette tape. You guys, you give your woman a cassette tape now after 18 years, 19 years, 27 years of marriage? You're going to get some. Ode for payphones. All that autumn, I walked from the apartment shared with my sisters to that payphone on 3rd Avenue next to a sleazy gas station and down the block from the International House of Pancakes. I was working the night shift at a pizza joint and you were away at college. You dated a series of inconsequential boys. Well, each boy meant little on his own, but their cumulative effect devastated my brain and balls. I wanted you to stop kissing relative strangers, so I called you at midnight as often as I could afford. If I talked to you that late, I knew or hoped you couldn't rush into anybody's bed. But oh, I still recall the misery of hearing the ring, 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 ring of your unanswered phone. These days, I text you to find you, but where's the delicious pain in that? God, I miss standing in the mosquito dark at this or that payphone. I wish that I could find one and call back all that I loved. So people are always asking me how autobiographical what I've done is, what I've written. It's a big question. And I think other writers get it, but I think ethnic writers tend to get it more. I'm not sure anybody's ever asked John Updike or John Irving, like, John Irving, are there dancing bears in your house? Toni Morrison, is your house haunted? They probably do ask those. But so I'm going to read you this question and answer, call and response thing, and then I'm going to talk about fiction a little bit. So this is called Bird Watching at Night. What kind of bird is that? An owl. What kind of bird was that? Another owl. Oh, that one was too quick and small to be an owl. What was it? A quick and small owl. You know, one night when I was 16, I was driving with my girlfriend up on Little Falls Flat, and this barn owl swooped down over the road maybe 50 feet or so in front of us and came flying straight toward our windshield. It was huge, pterodactyl size, and my girlfriend screamed, and well, I screamed too because that thing was heading straight for us. But you know what I did? I slammed on the gas and I sped toward the owl. Do you know why I did that? because he wanted to play chicken with the owl. Exactly. So what happened? When we were maybe a second from smashing into each other, that owl just flapped its wings, but barely. What's a better word than flap? What's a word that still means flap, but a smaller flap? How about slant? Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. So like I was saying, as that owl was just about to smash into our windshield, it slanted its wings and slanted up into the dark, and it was so friggin' amazing, you know? I just slammed on the brakes and nearly slid into the ditch, and my girlfriend and I were sitting there in the dark with the engine tick, tick, ticking like some kind of bomb, but an existential bomb, like it was measuring out the endless nothingness of our lives, because that owl had nearly touched us but was gone forever. And I said something like, "That was magnificent." And my girlfriend, you want to know what she said? She said something like, "I'm breaking up with you." Damn, that's exactly what she said. And I asked her, "Why are you breaking up with me?" And you know what she said? She said, "I'm breaking up with you because you are not that owl." Yeah. How do you know that? I never stopped thinking about her, though. I've never stopped thinking about her. It's been 27 years, and I still miss her. Why is that? Brother, you don't miss her. You miss that owl. So what actually happened is spring of my senior year, I was riding with Tom Beatty, Dan Beatty Brothers, and my best friend Steve from the Rez, so two white guys and two Indians, and we were engaged in spring of our senior year activities. We were drinking a lot of Diet Pepsi, tons and tons of Diet Pepsi. That was, you know how Diet Pepsi lowers your inhibitions. We were driving down the road, and I was at a Diet Pepsi in the back, I dropped it. And it was splurting all over the place. And I was leaning down to pick it up, and it kept getting away from me, and it slid under the seat. So I was reaching under the seat, so I was down underneath. And at that moment, this giant barn owl came swooping down into the headlights. And Steve slammed on the brakes, and I went slamming into the back of the car, and we skidded and spun and went into the ditch a little bit. And I'm going, "What happened? What happened? What happened?" I look up, and Tom and Dan and Steve are all like this. And I'm going, "What happened?" And that was the biggest friggin' owl I've ever seen. It was bigger than the damn car. It was huge. It was like a dinosaur. It was like some In Search Of episode. You know, they're going on and on about this amazing pterodactyl owl, prehistoric creature that came flying into the window. And they all looked at me, "Didn't you see it?" No. So that's the story of fiction. So I'll read this little bit here. It's an exit interview for my father, and then I'll answer questions. How does that sound? So I've been on book tour for a while, so my voice goes out. Can you hear this? Yeah, so I've done 17 readings in 20 days. So this is part of a larger story called War Dances, an exit interview for my father on his deathbed as he's dying, the character, father, not mine. Exit interview for my father. True or false? When a reservation-raised Native American dies of alcoholism, it should be considered death by natural causes. Do you understand the term wanderlust? And if you do, can you please tell us in 25 words or less what place made you wanderlust the most? Did you, Dad, when drunk, ever get behind the tattered wheel of a 76 Ford three-speed van and somehow drive your family 1,000 miles on an empty tank of gas? Is it true that the only literary term that has any real meaning in the Native American world is road movie? During the last road movie you saw, how many times did the characters ask, "Are we there yet?" How many times during any of your road trips did your children ask, "Are we there yet?" In 25 words or less, Dad, please define there. Sir, in your 39 years as a parent, you broke your children's hearts collectively and individually 612 times. And you did this without ever striking any human being in anger. Does this absence of physical violence make you a better man than you might otherwise have been? Without using the words man or good, can you please define what it means to be a good man? Do you think you will see angels when you die? Do you think angels will come to escort you to heaven? As the angels are carrying you to heaven, how many times will you ask, "Are we there yet?" Your son distinctly remembers stopping once or twice a month at that grocery store in Freeman, Washington, where you would buy him a red, white, and blue rocket popsicle and purchase for yourself a pickled pigfoot. Your son distinctly remembers the feet still had their toenails and little tufts of pig fur. Could this be true, Dad? Did you actually eat such horrendous food? Your son has often made the joke that you were the only Indian of your generation who went to Catholic school on purpose. This is, of course, a tasteless joke that makes light of the forced incarceration and subsequent physical, spiritual, cultural, and sexual abuse of tens of thousands of Native American children in Catholic and Protestant boarding schools. In consideration of your son's questionable judgment in telling jokes, do you think there should be any moral limits placed on comedy? Your oldest son and your two daughters, all over 36 years of age, still live in your house. Do you think this is a lovely expression of tribal culture? Or is it a symptom of extreme familial codependence? Or is it both things at the same time? F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that the sign of a superior mind is the ability to hold two opposing ideas at the same time. Do you believe this is true? And is it also true that you once said, the only time white people tell the truth is when they keep their mouth shut? A poet once wrote, pain is never added to pain, it multiplies. Can you tell us in 25 words or less exactly how much we all hate mathematical blackmail? Your son, in defining you, wrote this poem to explain one of the most significant nights in his life. It's called Mutually Assured Destruction. When I was 9, my father sliced his knee with a chainsaw. But he let himself bleed and finished cutting down one more tree before his boss drove him to emergency. Late that night, stoned on morphine and beer, my father needed my help to steer his pickup into the woods. "Watch for deer," my father said. "Those things just appear like magic." It was an Indian summer, and we drove through warm rain and thunder until we found that chainsaw lying under the fallen pine. Then I watched with wonder as my father, shotgun rich and impulse poor, blasted that chainsaw dead. "What was that for?" I asked. "Son," my father said, "here's the score. Once a thing tastes blood, it will come for more." Well, first of all, as you know, you did cut your knee with a chainsaw, but in direct contradiction to your son's poem, you immediately went to the emergency room after injuring yourself. Your boss called your wife, who drove you to the emergency room. You were given morphine, but even you were not alcoholically stupid enough to drink alcohol while on serious narcotics. You and your son did not get into the pickup that night. And even if you had driven the pickup, you were not injured seriously enough to need your son's help with the pedals and or steering wheel. You never in your life used the word "up here," and certainly never used the phrase "like magic." You also agree that Indian summer is a fairly questionable seasonal reference for an Indian to use. And what the fuck is warm rain and thunder? Well, everybody knows what warm rain is, but what the fuck is warm thunder? You never went looking for that chainsaw because it belonged to the Spokane tribe of Indians, and what kind of freak would want to reclaim the chainsaw that had just cut the shit out of his knee? You also agree that the entire third stanza of this poem sounds like a Bruce Springsteen song, and not necessarily one of the good ones. And yet, shotgun rich and impulse poor is one of the greatest descriptions your son has ever written and probably redeems the entire poem. You never owned a shotgun. You did own a few rifles during your lifetime, but did not own even so much as a pellet gun during the last 30 years of your life. You never said in any context, "Once a thing tastes your blood, it will come for more." But you, as you read it, Dad, know that it is absolutely true and does indeed sound suspiciously like your entire life philosophy. Other summations of your life philosophy include, "I'll be there before the next teardrop falls." And if God really loved Indians, he would have made us white people. And Oscar Robinson should be the man on the NBA logo. They only put Jerry West on there because he's a white guy. And a peanut butter sandwich with onions. That's the way to go. and why eat a pomegranate when you can eat a plain old apple or peach or orange? When it comes to fruit and vegetables, only eat the stuff you understand. And if you really want a woman to love you, then you have to dance. And if you don't want to dance, then you're going to have to work extra hard to make a woman love you forever. And you will always run the risk that she will leave you at any second for a man who knows how to tango. And, oh, I really miss those cafeterias they used to have in Kmart. I don't know why they stopped having those. If there is a heaven, then I firmly believe it's a Kmart cafeteria. And a father always knows what his sons are doing. For instance, boys, I knew you were sneaking out that Hustler magazine. You know, the one in my bedroom? You remember that one where the actors who looked like Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura were screwing on the bridge of the Enterprise? Yeah, that one. I know you kept borrowing it. I let you borrow it. Remember this? Men and pornography are like plants and sunshine. To us, porn is photosynthesis. And your mother is a better man than me. Mothers are almost always better men than men are. I like that because they didn't fill it all up because there's no way in hell I would drink the whole thing. So, and then I would spill it. So questions, comments, insults, rebuttals, predictions. That's a damn good team you're playing. I don't know. Oh, man, that was great. I love you, Booth.
I have some questions from students of mine who are reading your book right now.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ones I thought was really interesting is, who of the characters in True Diary are you still in touch with?
Who of the characters in True Diary am I still in touch with?
Yeah, like they were wondering about Penelope, of course, especially, but...
Oh, they're wondering about
Rowdy,
Penelope?
And what happened to Rowdy, and they had all the...
Well, they're fictional characters, so...
Yeah.
The events, the things that people did, and the way the characters are very different than the real folks. But there are people in my life who played the same roles. The Penelope in the book is based on three different women at three different points in my high school career of dating. But two of them I'm still in contact with. I just in a Midwestern city, one of the Penelopes came with her husband to the reading. They always come. So, I borrowed the book from her to read from that night. And usually when I do the French thing, I do more intense interaction with the book, with the French guy, you know, fondling the book. And it was her book, I realized, after about 5 minutes. And she was the head cheerleader in high school, and I was the head captain of the basketball team, but we never dated. But we should have. So I felt like the book was the proxy. So I'm not so sure how her husband felt about that. No, it's fine. I was flirting with her right in front of him. It's great. Because when you're up at a podium flirting with somebody's wife, the guys are like, yeah, that's so great. You're doing it in a bar, you'd get punched. But somehow or another, the podium gives you power. And the other Penelope was a romantic relationship of mine. And we're still in email contact. And actually, it was so cute. You know, the book, there's a lot of her in the book. But her husband, actually, she didn't know it was coming out or hadn't heard about it yet. But her husband got it and sent it to me and had me sign it for her. And then he gave it to her as a present, you know. I mean, the book about his wife's high school boyfriend writing about her. I thought, that's a secure dude, man. Because I'm famous and shit. So that was pretty cool. But I'm really loyal. People are, but Indians are really just hang on. I tribe up with everybody. I don't care if you're Indian or not. You become my friend. I got you. You're in my clutches. So I email 20 or 30 people I went to high school with. This last weekend was my 20th year college reunion. I couldn't go because I was on book tour, but I got over 100 text messages and photos from the parties that were happening. So, I've been sending them back to them because most of them were sending them drunk. So, it's like, did you really mean to send this image? What are you, 15? So, yes. So, I hang on to people. And there's a sophomore year coming, a sequel. The sophomore year is called, the novel is called The Magic and Tragic Year of My Broken Thumb. So it's sophomore year. And the junior year is called The First and Last Crusade of Arnold Spirit Jr. And I don't know what the senior year is called, because you know, they have to keep selling for me to keep writing them. It's called To Be Announced. Did that answer your question? Okay. Rowdy is a combination of a couple guys, and they still live on the res.
Hello. I was the... sorry, holding it too close. I was the lady that talked to you on WHYY today about the school project.
Oh, about Oscar?
Yes.
Oh, did you hear that? Oh, did you hear the radio with Marty Moscoane today? Well, can you explain it?
Okay. Well, I run a nonprofit for animals in Camden, and I was contacted by the Absagami High School principal, who I think might be here tonight, to come down and put together a humane curriculum at their high school, because they're all reading your book. The entire high school is reading your book. And we wanted to do something for humane education, and so I'm down there now facilitating the students. We're building a mock nonprofit. We're putting together a mock nonprofit, and it's going to be called OSCAR, OSCAR, Our Students Contributing to Animal Rescue. And the money that we raise is we're going to go into the inner cities and the areas where needy animals are and give them free shots, because I believe, that your Oscar may have passed away from a disease called parvo, from how you described it, with the severe diarrhea and the hot weather and everything. So we're going to go down with the money we raise and give out free shots to the animals there. And we're dying to know what kind of dog he was.
In True Diary, the first chapter is the thinly disguised fictional version of a childhood pet of mine named Oscar. Got sick, and we didn't have money. We were poor to take him to the vet. So my uncle came over and shot him. The chapter is about how do you know when you're poor. That's certainly one measure of it, when you can't take care of your dogs, when you can't take your pets, you can't give them health care. And as we all know, our pets are family members, and that dog was my best friend. And so it's really amazing to have this happen. So I'm thinking of Oscar, that little furry mutt, wherever, you know, his spirit is. I don't know how that works. None of us do. Don't lie. I think it's a really beautiful way to honor him. So it's amazing what books do. I didn't plan it. But that book has been amazing, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Somebody, is there a high schooler with their hand up? Back there, me! No, me!
So we go to Germantown Friends School.
You go to where?
Germantown Friends.
Germantown Friends, okay.
Yeah.
In Germantown.
Yeah, and our school was going to put on the play Peter Pan.
Uh-huh.
And
we remembered our whole 10th grade read your book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto.
Uh-huh.
And I remember there was this passage in it where you're talking about how it's the little things that hurt the most. and Tonto and the Washington Redskins, and we're wondering, like, whether...
Well, our school decided that, sorry, that they shouldn't put Peter Pan is too...
After a lot of discussion, they decided not to put on...
Like derogatory or...
Of the racist portrayals of the Indians, and we're wondering whether, like, what, how would you...
It's incredibly racist. Change it. Use some other means of that whole concept, the idea of what the Indians represented. Have the football team up there dancing. I've heard from various places across the country who've done Peter Pan reinterpretations of the Indians. My wife bid on an auction item at Children's Theater in Seattle. In December, I actually have a one-night cameo as a pirate in a stage production of Peter Pan. So, but I called him. I said, "So what are you doing about the Indians?" And they're doing a multicultural dance sequence, which is hilariously politically correct, but necessary. And I can't wait to put on my Spanx. I'm going to be a giant, terrifying pirate because it's theater. They're all this big. So reinterpret that sequence. Shoot, do Beyonce's. That's actually a pretty good idea. So, plays are made to be reinterpreted. Art is made to be reinterpreted, especially when it comes from an earlier time when all sorts of really terrible stuff was completely acceptable. So do it. Change it up. Do the play. It's a beautiful story. Peter Pan's a beautiful story. The whole subtext is great. I mean, Peter Pan's gay. I remember even as a little kid watching it going... Cool. So there's all sorts of wonderful themes, and it's actually a terrifying story. So just get that in. It's the only really bad part about it is the Indian stuff. So. It's top five catchiest song of all time. I lost my phone in Portland, Oregon on book tour, and I went into the store to get it replaced, and that song came on, and we all started going like that. Two customers and three people working in there, and we all looked at each other, and when the chorus came on, we all sang. You like it, then you should have put a ring on it. If you like it, then you should have put a ring on it. And then we all got really embarrassed. So the stuff I can do up here and say up here, it doesn't translate in out there. Now we should go for... I got it. Speaking of politically correct, that white man over there.
Thank you.
I'm really enjoying... Because here's a secret, the whole... white man pissed off because it's worse for him thing. The secret is, it actually is. And the difference between conservative white men and liberal white men is that liberal white men are dealing with it. They're like, okay, it's getting worse for me. Okay. And conservative white men are, fuck this. So that's the difference. They're not lying. It is getting worse for you, white guys. It's incrementally getting worse for you. You're having to share. But don't worry. You still own 97% of everything. So except for me. There's at least one Indian who has more than you, and a president. So, look what you caused me to do, white guy.
How do I follow that?
It's all your fault.
I wanted to ask you, as much as I love your writing, I love your films even more. When are you going to direct again, and what kind of screenplays are you working on?
Oh, you saw the one I directed?
I reviewed it.
It actually, it did well here. That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's right. It was sort of, there was these anomalous places where it would, you know, you'd look at the chart of where it's playing and there'd be these spikes. And who knew? Philadelphia would, you know, Philadelphia was hungry for a weird experimental film about a gay Native American poet. Who knew there was this aching absence, you know, of gay Native American themes in Philadelphia? But I love the, you know, the Liberty Bell, gay Native poets. And I like being here for all that stuff, though. I walked around today. I'm patriotic. But I am, which is Native. We Indians are more patriotic than any other group in the country. It's so strange. It seems ironic and oxymoronic and contradictory, and it is. Back in college, two Nez Perce friends and I were drinking Diet Pepsi and in a bar, and I've been sober a long time, and we were slamming on the country, you know, and my friend Wilford was really going for it. I hate this country, and a white kid came up and said, I hate this country too, it treated you Indians like shit, and Wilford just, bam, just dropped him. You know, and he's unconscious, and we're dragging Wilford out, and he's screaming, nobody talks shit about my country except me! Which I think would be a great scene in a movie. I think that would be the great first scene in a movie. You know, I think people would be going, whoa! So, that said, the movie industry has changed completely. It's impossible to get an independent film made. If anything is going to be made, I'm going to be shooting it for $10,000. You know, and I'm lucky enough that I have a sort of built-in audience to where I can afford that and sell DVDs off, you know, out of my website, which is what we're currently planning. So there's a couple projects in the works. A movie based on What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. And a movie based with a few stories out of Toughest Indian in the World. Including the Toughest Indian in the World. I have a documentary I've submitted to Sundance, which I shouldn't tell you because it won't get in, and you'll be reading the paper and you'll be looking and you're going, oh, poor Sherman. I continue to write for Hollywood, so I'm currently working on a big-ass movie. And I just got a call from my manager, and for some reason, waves happen in Hollywood. If you've seen a movie called The Big Picture, where all these rumors get started and suddenly somebody gets hot, I've had that wave this week in Hollywood. So she was getting a lot of calls for some strange reason. And so now I'm getting approached because they're wanting to develop some TV series. So there's a couple networks who want to try making a Western with a strong Indian presence in it. So, which is pretty cool. So, I can't wait to, you know, the opening scenes of braids and a cowboy hat and, you know, an Indian like Michael Gray Eyes, who's big and beautiful, walking down a street with, you know, sheriff, you know, of Indian town. Yeah. And I want it to be HBO, though, so, I mean, hasn't been enough, you know, sex in the Old West. So sexy. And not Deadwood. Stuff that just scared the hell out of me. So, you know, a more bigger range of emotions. So who knows? In other words, so did that answer your question? I think I owe you $85 now. Are you a psychiatrist? You're a film critic? Okay. Yeah. Thank you for liking Fancy Dancing. I'm remembering the review now. What do you write for?
I write for
Okay. So you're the guy who liked it? I think there are five or six great scenes in it, and I think that almost redeems it, but I'm self-critical. You, there, yeah. Yeah, you. Wait for the mic. What flavor is your gum?
Five gum. Peppermint.
It's what?
Five gum.
Five gum?
Yeah, it's called five gum.
It's five different kinds of gum?
No, it's just called five gum.
It's called five gum. Is that something local?
Yes.
I've never heard of five gum. No. You have Utz, though. I like that. Utz. That's such an unappetizing name. You know, I was in the convenience store thinking, you know, some chips would be good. Utz. That's a noise I'll be making later after I've eaten them. And if the Utz family is here, I'm sorry. What was that? No, I know. I bought them. But, I mean, don't you love that when you travel, trying out other people's fast food and other people's chips? That's all, that's a great experience. That's an adventure. I don't drink anymore, so I got to do something for my loneliness. No, diet pet, it's chips. You know, $9 Toblerone bars from the mini bar in the hotel. I don't pay for them, so, you know, you get back after this and you're looking at them. That's looking pretty good. That Toblerone bar. I'm looking at that Toblerone bar like I used to look at that poster of Farrah Fawcett, you know. That was my homage to Farrah. She was important. So, your question?
Do you like being an Indian?
Do I like being an Indian?
Yeah.
Are you in high school? Yeah. High schoolers just ask any old shit, right? That's so great. So, why do you parents think you're having to protect your kids, right? I mean, you need to be protected from your child, not the other way around. You know, high school kids go, how much money did you make last year? Shitload. I probably paid more in taxes than your parents made. Yeah! It's not necessarily true. But, yeah. But, you know, Indian is such a, I mean, it's a multiplicity of cultural, political, economic, tribal influences and ceremonies and ideas. And all too often, any identity, the people in that identity keep close guard on it. And when you deviate from the accepted way of being that thing, then you're not that thing. So, you know, I've always been the weird one. I've always been a rebel inside my little group. And even now, as an adult, as a writer, as a Native American writer and political thinker and, you know, half-assed intellectual, you know, I'm still often at odds with common Native American thinking. So, yeah, I love being an Indian, but I also love fighting the idea of what an Indian is supposed to be. And other people interpret that as me not liking to be Indian. And that's not what it is. It's me not liking them. I just get a good hate on, and it's not self-hatred. It's completely directed outward, trust me. So there you go. That's a really good answer. Thank you. No, I mean, because your honesty really, you know, open, yeah.
My sister would always yell at me because I would tell people that I was Indian, but she would be like, no, you're Native American.
Oh.
So she would always yell at me.
Well, watch this. Everybody who was born in North, Central, or South America, raise your hand. You're all Native American. That's what native means. Raise them again, everybody born here. So Native American isn't any more an accurate term than Indian is. It's just semantics. Tell your sister she's full of shit. Is that your sister right there? I mean, because it gets so, the language of it, and I'm all those things, right? Indigenous, but that makes me sound like I'm walking around with like a, stone hatchet. First Nations, like the Canadians call it, and that's like my tribe built pyramids or something, and we didn't. We kind of wandered around fishing, First Nations, fishing village. Collectively it was a nation, I guess, but we fought each other, so first provincialists. I think that's probably more accurate. What else is there? Aboriginal? Now there, yeah, that's a good one. It sounds like I'm drawing my poems on cave walls. So Amerindian, I see that one. which is like, Reese's peanut butter and chocolate put together. But and the thing is, all of us, our racial identities, our cultural identities are the first floors of our houses. We go in, we visit each other, we hang out, we watch TV, we have dinner. We visit, we play some music, we dance, we make out on the couch. But the real interesting stuff inside of anybody is in the attic and in the basement. And that's where art is made, out of the material in the attic and in the basement. The other stuff is just making out on the couch, which is important, don't get me wrong. But art is made out of the eccentricities of the individual. And now those eccentricities are highly influenced by that first floor. But it's still the attic and the basement, attic and the basement. I'm looking at all of you trying to figure out what you got up there and down there.
Do you like Indian pots?
Do I like Indian pots? I like pots in general. It's not a bad answer. Why should I have a special relate? We're not pot makers. Now, if you want to ask me about beadwork, if you want to ask me about baskets, if you want to ask me about what my tribe did, there's this association. This happens in Philadelphia. Are you that guy? Like 12 years ago, a guy asked me this in Philadelphia. He asked me this long, complicated question about the burial practices of the Navajo. And I said, I have no idea. I'm not Navajo. And he goes, well, you should know. You're Indian. And I said, the Navajo and I are as closely related as the Irish and the Chinese. Now, in this thing called Indian, we're related, but when it comes down to specific tribal practices, I know more about the evangelical Protestants of Eastern Washington than I do about the Navajo of the Southwest. And any Indian who tells you different about their relationship with other Indians is lying, 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 lying. There's a common Indian identity that we all share, a common cultural way of relating to each other. But once again, once you get into the basement and the attic of Navajo-ness, I know nothing about it. And I know their first floor where there's a lot of turquoise. So that's the answer to your question. How do you feel about cheesesteak?
I don't like it.
Okay, there you go. It was the same kind of question asking me that. So, yeah. So, back there. I like cheesecake.
This summer I read The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven for school,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering how much, if at all, is Thomas Builds a Fire related to you as a writer and a storyteller and a person.
You mean the Indian guy with glasses who talks all the time and says whatever comes off the top of his head?
He is you?
The guy who can be, the guy who's, can be really, really irritating? Nothing autobiographical about that character. I think Thomas is in, you know, I mean, when I say autobiographical, I mean I take aspects of myself and I put these characters, I assign these aspects to characters, and then I put the characters into fictional situations to see how some other version of me would behave. What would happen to some other version of me, some other tiny part of me. So I think Thomas, in a lot of ways, is the person I would have become if I'd stayed on the reservation. In order to psychically, spiritually survive, I would have had to become that weird. As opposed to now. I mean, this thing I've built is a complete accident. It's an utter anomaly. You know, there's no logical reason why I should have this career. Because I keep writing about the same 12 guys. You know, that was a weird Freudian Catholic slip. You're colonized, Sherman, so essentially, you know, my reservation is, I keep writing about it, you know, even when it's not the reservation, it still is. I'm lucky. Okay, maybe one more, I think. Yeah, one more. We're not going to talk about basketball tonight. Okay, yeah, you, because you're hot.
Thank you, Sherman.
You're welcome. Well, you are. You got that scarf, you know. How long did... It looks casual, but you probably spent like 45 minutes.
You know what? You're probably right, because yeah. I do that. One of the first stories that I read by you was What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. And I read it for a class, a short story class, and we had to break up in these groups, and we were talking about the story, and I was like, I hope he's Native American, because I would be really offended if he wasn't, you know. And they're like, oh, yeah, he is, you know. And this girl in my group was like, I mean, you don't have to be Native American to say something like that. I think that a person outside of being a Native American can embody this story and talk about it. And I'm thinking, no, because I wouldn't want to hear a story about African Americans like this unless an African American wrote it. Do you feel like that kind of like the, you know, no one talks shit about my country but me kind of thing when it comes to stories like what you write?
Oh, that's a good way to end. I used to be far more fundamental about this. You know, in my earlier incarnations as a writer, I was really voracious about non-Indians writing about Indians, and then I just stopped caring. In a lot of ways, because by and large, any non-Indian who attempts to write about Indians writes crap anyway. So I thought, why am I don't even have to defend it. I don't even have to say a word. Just read the book. It's crap. You know, it's very rare, you know, for a non-Indian to write well about Indians. It's very rare. Because I think by and large, when you're talking about great artists, you're talking about really obsessed people. And people who are writing out a very specific personal vision. And that personal vision is always related, you know, to their attic and their basement. When you write about another group of people that's not you, it's way too easy to stay in the living room. And I think that's what most people who write outside of themselves do, is they stay on the first floor. And it's very rare for somebody to extend past that. There's just been a handful of books by non-natives about natives that I think are good, and just a handful that are great. And most of the bad ones traffic in the same old spiritual bullshit, pretending that we have some sort of extra powers. You know, like we put capes on, you know, and fly around saving your soul. You know, when we're just as fragile and finite and troubled and disturbed and screwed up as any other group of people. But I was reading a blog post last year, and I'm not going to remember who wrote it, but he talked about the ways in which it was a black man that, you know, the way in which slavery, the idea of slavery, informs so much of black folks' identity. And James Baldwin said something similar, the idea of measuring our lives by how much pain we've had and letting our pain determine our entire identity. And so I think sometimes when we talk about outsiders writing about us, we only can think about it in terms of our pain. We can only think about it in terms of history. And sometimes we just need to look at it as art, as somebody attempting to write art, and then judge it as art. So don't judge it as, you know, colonialism or imperialism. Just judge it as art. And that's more fun, because then you get to say, God, this is shitty art. And that's just more fun. And it actually advances the dialogue to where it doesn't become about race. It becomes about the ability to see the human beings inside a group. And that's when it gets valuable. So, and we're all bad at it. I mean, that's why. I'm not telling you, because then you go buy them. Tom Spanbauer, Craig Leslie are two great, you know, guys who write well about natives. There's a couple of mystery writers who've done pretty well. Blanking on her name, but she writes the Anna Pigeon series, which is pretty good. Yeah. And so, but, you know, Hillerman, he wrote one or two that are good. But then what happens, see, I'm Hillerman, you know, sorry, Tony, but I didn't care what he was doing until I saw this photo album of pictures of the Southwest. And probably 90% of the photos were from Navajo land. And the title of this picture book was Tony Hillerman's Country. You know, so fuck you, Tony. I know that mesa right there. You know, I know who lives right around the corner. You know, I know whose truck goes by that mesa every day. It's not you, Tony. That's what happens. We as artists are thieves. We're colonial. We're imperialistic. All of us. I am. I'm a thief. I'm colonial. I'm imperialistic with people's experiences and ideas. We're all thieves. But we have to be careful about it. And we have to watch the ways in which our artistic thievery coincides with political thievery. And we have to be highly aware of that. I was just reading the paper today. The Philadelphia Weekly. It's a great way to end. The way in which people got stupid. It was a neighborhood that's gentrifying, and the people called themselves the something-something pioneers. It's like, oh, you fucking idiots. You know, it must have been the same meeting where Barnes & Noble decided to call that thing the Nook. You didn't call yourself the pioneers, did you? You know, white people in a black neighborhood, you called yourself the pioneers? Oh, my God. So it's that kind of stuff. And that kind of stuff, when it makes its way into literature, stands out. It's like neon, you know. Idiot, idiot, idiot. You know, no matter their beautiful motives, no matter what good they may be doing, no matter what art they have or what political movement they're behind, there's a neon sign above them going, idiot, idiot, idiot. Calling a group that's gentrifying a neighborhood the pioneers. You know, and then the article, you know, I don't know them. They may be here. I don't know. But they're wondering, why are people mad? Because you called yourself the fucking pioneers. You know, you couldn't have thought of a new word, you know. Yeah. Yeah, there's a new group on my reservation. It's a bunch of non-Indians helping with cleanup, you know. They call themselves the Seventh Cavalry. So thank you. I'll sign books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.